This is Phil Farron, and I'm driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 207, which means that next week is not the four-year anniversary. I decided that, in fact, I was using the wrong terminology. It's not the four-year anniversary. It is the anniversary. No, it is the celebration of 4 years of podcasts. That's what it is. My buddy who's going to be riding with me next week, we actually talked about this because I went back and looked up, and lo and behold, it was the last Friday in March of 2009 when I started doing these. And so since next week is actually the third week of March, not the fourth week of March, it's not technically the four-year anniversary, so we do try to be accurate around here since we had a period of time when we were nitpickers. So anyways, it's been a good week. It's been a long week. Got a lot of things accomplished though, and got my hours in this week, so it's good. I'm actually getting away a little later than I expected to, because just before we left, there was a little emergency job that came up, and I was asked to look into it, and they said it would be fine if you just want to wait till tomorrow morning to do it, but I thought, you know, I'm going to be close, and so I'm actually getting away just about an hour later than I intended. But that's okay, because now I can just write tomorrow on the writing front. Excuse me, that's better. There we go. On the writing front, I am, I think, about a chapter and a quarter away from having Amanda and the Scleaberry Tree roughed in, although I do have an appendix or an epilogue that I have to do, so actually about two and a little bit. We'll see if we can get that finished up this weekend. Maybe. And then after that, got to work on taxes. Got to get those under control. And then I'm going to loop back and do a read-through and then start working on the cover, start getting beta readers put together. Go from there. So far so good. It's cute. Lots of cute stuff in it. Just got to get the thing landed. And I think we're fine. I think you never really know until you get it all in. You step back from it for a little bit and then you go and you just read it straight through and see how the pacing is. And I know there's a little bit of tweaking and things that I need to do, but it's close enough. So sometimes when you get it close enough, you just need to keep plowing through it. And then when you have a chance to get away from it and actually know what all the pieces are, then that gives you a chance to get back to it and get it done. Okay. One moment. Is that better? Yes, that's better. Sometimes I get this weird thing in my ear where I can hear myself echoing back in my ear. And just makes a little weird. Anyways, this week, I would like to talk about something a little rough. It's a little difficult to hear. But it's something that I think would be good for us to talk about, even though it is difficult to hear. So I'm warning you right now, if you're squeamish at all, you might want to skip this episode, because a little difficult. There was an article called The Crime of His Childhood. It was in the New York Times. It was written by Wendell Jameson. And it concerns a man whose name is Joshua A. Miele, I think. M-I-E-L-E. He has his doctorate now, his PhD. But there was an incident when Dr. Miele was young that was just about as terrible as you can imagine happening to anyone. It occurred in 1973. It was October the 5th. At that time, Dr. Miele was 4 years old. Interestingly enough, the writer of this article looked like there was a kid that was getting ready to step in front of a truck there, and I thought, whoa, that's not gonna end well. Big truck. Anyways, interestingly enough, the writer of this article actually knew Dr. Miele, and perhaps that's what led him to write the article and what led the Times to actually publish it. So you have this young boy. Dr. Miele is a young boy. He's 4 years old. There's a doorbell that rings at his house, and so he sprints to get it. Very enthusiastic young boy. There's a young man on the other side of the gate. His name was Basilio Busa. He's 24. Joshua sees him, and he unlocks the gate in front of his door, and he hops up on the iron gate, and he pulls, and he uses his weight to open the iron gate because this young man is his neighbor, and he recognizes him. And Basilio Busa then proceeds to pour sulfuric acid on this little boy's head. And of course, the little boy doesn't know what's happened at first. He's grasping at his head. He's stumbling backwards. This is a bad day. Mom comes out. Somebody figures out what's going on. And, you know, they manage to get the hospital there. They get the boy to the hospital. It's not good. His eyes have been collapsed from the acid, so there's not really much chance. He has chemical burns across his face. In fact, the doctors at the hospital where he is said, you know, we can't treat this. We don't have the facilities for this. And if you don't get him to a military hospital, he's going to die. So his father starts camping out at the payphone at the hospital, and he just starts pounding the phone, finding anybody and everybody who will talk to him. He manages to get through to his congressman, and the congressman got in touch with the general surgeon's office, and then the phone call came from a Colonel Basil Pruitt, a doctor who was the head of the Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, the only military hospital at the time dedicated to treating burn victims. And Colonel Pruitt tells him, get the boy down here. We'll take care of him. And so, you know, the dad just keeps shoving more and more dimes into the payphone, manages to end up finding a helicopter pilot, desk sergeant at the 78 precinct, came up with a plan, figured out how to get this little boy down there so that they could treat him. You know, that then they were able to treat him and were able to save him, but there was months and months of recuperation. The little boy, Joshua, as a little boy, was able then to learn to walk with a cane. He attended the Industrial Home for the Blind in Brooklyn Heights. His dad builds him a bunk bed. It's part jungle gym with all kinds of bars and levers so that Joshua could climb and stretch his scarred underarms. His mom would put him in what she described as less than acceptable situations, I should say. She said, "I would let him touch things that you weren't supposed to touch in museums. I would let him climb on things that people would ordinarily not climb on." And he would say, "Mom, is this all right?" And I'd say, "Okay, do it." Good parents. I love these parents. Unfortunately, they had troubles in their marriage before this happened, and according to the people who knew them, said that they were probably going to get a divorce anyways. But this situation, unfortunately, may have hastened it, but they did eventually separate. And so Mom was left raising the children. And of course, through the course of Dr. Joshua Meal's life, there would be times when he would be out with his sister or his mom, and a child would see him, and the child would scream, "Mommy, Mommy, a monster, a monster." There came a point when he was 11 or 12 that he was scheduled for another surgery. They were going to try to stitch his arm to his burned nose, and then hopefully that would cause some blood vessels to regenerate. He finally said he'd had enough. That was it. He told his family, "I'm always going to look different. Why go through all that pain just to look a little less different?" And the article says that is how it was. It was time to start accepting his blindness and his face. It was time for him to simply start living life. Today, Dr. Meal lives in Berkeley, California. According to the article, he lives on a beautiful block of 1920s cottages. He lives there with his wife and his children, two children. And the writer of the article said that Dr. Meal was, in his words, deeply ambivalent about participating in the article. He said, "We sent emails back and forth, and we met for coffee in the fall while he was staying with his dad." He said, "I was a little nervous. I wondered how I would react to his appearance. He said, but I found it less off-putting than fascinating. His intelligence and sense of humor blazing through. And he quickly put me at ease." He said, "By the time I went to his house for dinner, the children running around, I had ceased being conscious of any difference between us." Dr. Meal has a degree in physics and a PhD in psychoacoustics from the University of California at Berkeley. He's been involved in many projects to help the blind with various things. He helped develop the tactile braille maps that are at every station of the Bay Area Rapid Transit. He's just finishing up and soon to releasing something called the Descriptive Video Exchange, that will, in theory, let anyone narrate any video that's on YouTube. And so you can have, in their, the example they gave, you can have Star Trek enthusiasts come and narrate videos that are on YouTube that are Star Trek videos, because that would give the a vision impaired person a much different perspective. It's interesting because Dr. Meal said, concerning the incident early in his life, that it's not that I don't want to be written about. He said, I'd like to be famous as the next person would. He said, but I want to be famous for the right reasons, for the work I've done, and not for some stupid thing that happened to me 40 years ago. And as I was reading through this article, I was first of all so impressed with Dr. Meal's parents and the way they approached him. But I was obviously also still very impressed with him. Because of the support that he had around him, because of the decisions he made as an individual, he said, I never doubted that it was going to work out. He said it was a foregone conclusion that it was going to be okay. As for the man who poured the acid on this young boy, apparently he was having some real mental problems. He was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. For some reason, had become fixated on this little four-year boy, that this little four-year boy was bothering him, was part of the cause of his problems. What the young man did destroy his family. No one really recovered in the entire family from their brother and from their son doing this to an innocent child. Interestingly enough, Dr. Josh Meal worries about the fact that Carmen Bosa, the sister of the man who poured the acid on him, you know, still suffers. And he said that he wondered about calling her to tell her it's okay, that everything has worked out. You know, and when I read this story, I'm getting my mail, one moment. When I'm reading this story, the one thing that comes back to me as I'm reading this story is that great Hindu saying that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And I see that so true in this story. While it is true that he had great parents, Dr. Meal had great parents, and they certainly provided a foundation for him, it is also true that he chose. That he chose to move beyond that attack. That he chose to move beyond the unkindness of strangers. And that he chose to focus on something else. I'm backing into my garage. And I think what this shows is the same thing that it shows of the podcast that I did many, many months ago about the young woman who had acid thrown on her. That no matter what the horrific experience might be that we go through, that there is an amazing resilience in the human spirit. There is an amazing ability to convince ourselves that it's going to be okay if we'll just afford ourselves that. And I honestly think that that's because it will be okay. Because at the base of this existence, even though there is great sorrow sometimes in this existence, even though there is great pain in this existence, it's not the end. This existence is not all we'll have. I firmly believe that beyond this, there is an amazing, amazing thing waiting for us. And I think the truth of that we can sense and feel as God whispers to us down at the base of our experience, I think the truth of that then provides us strength, if we will allow it, to walk through whatever path we find before us. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.